Merry Christmas and season's greetings to all our listeners at this spot on the dial. From yours truly, Jimmy Stewart.
This is Mariah Carey.
This is Brian Wilson.
This is Gloria Estefan.
This is Engelbert Humperdinck, and you're listening to the Sounds of Christmas
podcast.
Hi, I'm Ken Kessler, and welcome to the Sounds of Christmas podcast. If you're new to this podcast, I'm going to start by saying thanks for joining us. If you're not new, welcome back. Either way, I'm glad you're here. Now, to avoid any confusion, I want to start off by saying there won't be any music played here. This is a place for conversation. I'll talk about Christmas music and some related topics, sometimes by myself and sometimes with guests. If you're looking for music, just go to soundsofchristmas.com and click on the tree or the player on the front page or on the Listen Now page. We play the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when we play the best variety of Halloween music. I'm very excited to have Alonzo Duraldi with me today on the Sounds of Christmas podcast. Hi, Alonzo.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. This is really exciting. I want to establish credentials before we get to talk to your book. For anybody who doesn't recognize your name, you're a film critic, author, and podcaster. You have been a writer and editor for The Film Verdict, The Wrap, The Advocate, MSNBC, Rotten Tomatoes. Am I right so far?
Yeah, I mean, my stuff has appeared on Rotten Tomatoes. I take it back. I have written some articles for the site. So, yeah, we'll count that too. Why not?
Okay. Artistic director at the USA Film Festival in Dallas.
Yes.
Arts and entertainment editor at The Advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Film critic for MSNBC.com.
Yes.
Reviews appearing regularly on the Rotten Tomatoes show.
Oh, wow. That's an oldie but a goodie.
Okay. Member of the Los Angeles Film Critic Association, the National Society of Film Critics. Writing has appeared also in The Village Voice, Movie Line, Detour, film critic for The Wrap, syndicated in Reuters. So good chance everybody listening to this has read at least one of your reviews.
I hope so.
Co-hosted the program What the Flick, which I think, was that a YouTube show?
Yes. Okay. It was on the Young Turks Network, and then they canceled us, and then we sort of reformed as Breakfast All Day, which is running to this day. Christy Lemire and I are doing that show on YouTube as well.
Okay. Also, the chief U.S. film critic for the Film Verdict, and you do podcasts, The Linoleum Knife, and are you just recurring on Deck the Hallmark, or are you one of the hosts?
I'm one of their current thing is there's sort of a third chair that rotates. So like Brian does the new Hallmark movies and Jax does some of the Hallmark series, and Ryan Popola and Patrick Serrano come in for various things. And my usual gig is I pop in once a week and we'll review a Christmas movie of recent vintage that aired somewhere other than Hallmark or Lifetime and kind of get caught up with that.
Okay. So lots of credentials. I didn't want to turn this into This Is Your Life, but I just wanted to establish it because your new book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, the revised and updated edition, is just out.
Yes.
And the original came out in 2010, I think.
That's right.
Okay. Do you remember the first movie that made you want to write about movies?
Ooh, good question. I don't exactly. I just remember that movies were always a thing that I was kind of just very fixated on. There's a scene in the film Searching for Bobby Fischer where a kid who is about to become a chess prodigy sees his first game of chess being played in a park, and he comes home and immediately sort of recreates the board using like stuffed animals and toys because it just has stuck in his mind. And I was sort of the same way with movies in that, like, before I even really started going to movies on a regular basis, I would read the listings every day in the newspaper. I could tell you what was showing at theaters, you know, in our neighborhood. And so it's something that I've just always been really interested in. My mom really liked movies, so we would watch them on TV a lot. I grew up in the pre-VCR, pre-cable era, so it was a matter of, you know, circling things in TV Guide or, you know, maybe when you got lucky, getting to go see things at a repertory house in Atlanta where I grew up. And then I remember watching Siskel and Ebert when they first started in the mid-70s and sort of realizing, oh, that's a job. like you get paid to do that for a living. And so that I sort of fixated on that, but I can't think of an individual film that prompted that. But I think once I realized the idea that you could be a film critic, you know, and that would be your job, I was on board.
How about the first Christmas movie that you reviewed? Any idea?
Oh man. I'm going to say, as far as like officially, because you know I'm one of those guys who like I wrote reviews for my high school paper and my college paper. My first professional review of a Christmas movie was probably writing about Scrooged in 1988 for the Nashville Banner, where I worked for a while. That's probably the first one. But even by that point, I had already been asked to do features over the years of like, what are, you know, 10 Christmas movies that people don't think of as Christmas movies, or 10 Christmas horror movies or whatever. And it was those lists that kind of directly led to me creating Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
Has there been our tastes change over the years, certainly. Has there been a movie that initially you really didn't like, you might have even panned in a review, but has kind of grown on you over the years?
Yeah, not necessarily Christmas movies, although I'm sure if I thought about it, I could probably come up with some. But like, I do remember the first time I saw Bringing Up Baby when I was in college. And I thought, this is a little shrill. It's a little over the top. And of course, I had grown up with What's Up, Doc, which is basically an homage to Bringing Up Baby. So I liked the copy and not the original. And then years later, I watched Bringing Up Baby again and realized, oh, no, this is genius. This is a really, really funny movie. And it's so sharp and it's so firing on all cylinders. And so now I love that and What's Up, Doc.
So it seems, I don't know, 15 years for this new version of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas comes out. And it seems like there have certainly been a lot of movies, if you count Hallmark or not. But has there been anything in particular that led you to decide, you know what, it's time for a new version?
Yeah, I mean, you know, from the moment that it came out, there were like, Rare Exports opened and Arthur Christmas opened. And there was just every year there were several new ones where I think, oh, man, I wish I could go back and like, you know, add to the first one, because there's just this sort of constant stream. And then also I was rediscovering, or rather discovering, films that I hadn't seen before. You know, TCM has been really great in the last couple of years about really packing their December with Christmas stuff. And it's not just the ones you would expect. So they were getting really deep into like sort of holiday noir, for instance, which was I had somehow missed out on a lot of these movies. So things like Mr. Soft Touch or Blast of Silence or I Wouldn't Be in Your Shoes. And so, you know, I definitely wanted to kind of go back and readdress that. And I think what's really changed a lot in the 15 years, besides the explosion of Hallmark, which I don't really cover in the book, but I have in other books, is shows like this, frankly. You know, I think the explosion of media about Christmas media is a relatively new thing. You know, I think when I put the first book out, maybe the Christmas Stocking podcast had started by that point. I don't remember when Lee kicked off that podcast. But as far as like podcasts about Christmas movies, about Christmas shows, about Christmas music, about Christmas food, you know, that's all still, that's pretty relatively new. So I almost feel like I'm releasing this book into a completely different environment. And certainly I've got a lot more places to promote it, because there has been this real uptick in people realizing, oh, I can talk about Christmas stuff all year round, and there are people who will tune in and want to listen and talk about it and explore this stuff and maybe, you know, watch these movies or listen to these records when it isn't December. And so that's been a really exciting change to witness in the landscape.
I can remember around the time the book originally came out, when there were, I don't know, it was like, there were like three or four different HBOs and Cinemaxes. Mm-hmm. And I'd get them all on some satellite service. And even in months that are far away from Christmas, occasionally Scrooged or Christmas Vacation or something right, like that would pop up. But now I can open up Netflix or Amazon Prime or, you know, any one of lots of streaming channels and find all of those things. And it is like, you know, you can watch them anytime you want.
Yeah. You know, when I was researching the first edition back in you know, 2009, 2010, I was renting DVDs from all over the place. Netflix was still renting them by mail. There was another service called Green Cine that I think no longer exists. There were still video stores near me where I could go rent stuff. And now pretty much everything in this book, with a few exceptions, and thankfully Scarecrow Video in Seattle still does DVD by mail. Just about everything I watched was via a streamer. And in fact, there are a ton of titles in this edition that are Netflix movies, you know, films like Klaus or Holiday or Jingle Jangle or, you know, Let It Snow. These are all, you know, that were films that were created by or at least for, you know, the streamer. So yeah, that's the other big change I'd say since 2010 is that streaming is where it's at as far as, you know, getting to see movies, although I'm still a big physical media fan.
I do like the physical media, but I've moved enough times that I don't mind that it's in the cloud. I know Hallmark probably gets credited with creating Christmas streaming movies, but you know, all the ones you mentioned, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, they all make their own stuff, and mm-hmm. some of it is really pretty good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, Happiest Season, which was supposed to be a theatrical release in 2020 and then obviously couldn't because of the lockdown, became, you know, a Hulu film and did really well for them. I think Netflix, I mean, I think that Hallmark has sort of maybe made people realize what kind of hunger there is for this content, you know, and so every year it's on the downslide now, but a couple of years ago we were making crazy amounts of new holiday movies every year. And I think it's still a thing where if you're a low budget filmmaker and you can crank one of these babies out in a certain amount of time for a certain amount of money and then stick it on, like, you know, Tubi or any of the sort of ad supported channels, like, you can maybe make a profit. That seems to be the way that people are going. But yeah, I would say Hallmark made other networks realize, oh, we got to get in on this because their numbers are insane for this last quarter of the year in a time when cable television is otherwise kind of dying on the vine.
Yeah, it's I think of it as a lot like traditional radio in the 1990s. A handful of stations decided that they were going to start going all Christmas mm-hmm. around Thanksgiving, maybe even earlier, and other stations would laugh at them, but then the ratings would come out in January and they're on top. And now every market, at least every market in America, has at least one traditional station that is the Christmas music station. And yeah, sometime in November, sometimes right around Halloween, they go all Christmas, and there is a market for it. People want it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, the way that there has been this explosion in podcasts like this one, I think people are less embarrassed about even, you know, sort of acknowledging, yeah, you know what, it's August, it's July, it's April, but I would like to hear, you know, some Perry Como right now. And so, you know, when the lockdown first started and Hallmark Channel started doing these weekend long Christmas movie marathons in March, I think it really sort of indicated to people, oh yeah, these are comforting. People are turning to these for a sense of coziness and trying to, you know, a distraction from what's going on around them. And then SiriusXM started letting holiday traditions run all year round. And I can't be the only one who pops into that one every so often. So, you know, obviously there's a market, there's a hunger, there's interest in stuff like this, you know, whatever the season.
Yeah. When I started doing this podcast 5 years ago, I had said in the first episode, I thought maybe there might be somebody out there who wanted to hear some conversation about Christmas music or tangential Christmas talk, right, besides just me. So I was going to sort of throw it out there and see. And yeah, I've been very surprised that there are other Christmas weirdos like me who want that.
I talk about this in the book. My friend William Bibbiani, I should have listened to him after the first edition came out. He said, we should start a podcast where we talk about Christmas movies year round. And I'm like, that's insane. Who would tune in for that? And now you can't turn around without finding not just Christmas movie podcasts, but like the subdivisions. You know, here's the Christmas foreign film podcast and the Christmas horror film podcast. And, you know, like all of these different categories. Like I had a chance to get in on the ground floor and I blew it.
Any idea how many Christmas movies you mention in the new revised version?
Probably a couple hundred. I haven't really sat down and counted, because what happened was my original thought was to do a sequel to the first book. And then the publisher said, well, you can't really do a Christmas movie book and not mention all of the classics. And you've already got all the classics in the first one. So we have to keep that. So when it became, you know, this was going to be a revised and updated edition, I didn't want to lose the stuff that was in the first book, but I also had to create a book that was going to be about the same size. So a lot of stuff that's in the first book is now kind of shrunk down to maybe like a couple of sentences and a, hey, you should also check out this. And then I go a little longer. I kept some of the long passages from the first one, and then I went long for some new stuff. So even if you have this book already, you will get a lot new out of this edition. And if you don't, this edition will cover all the bases and give you stuff. And if you see films in there that you wish I had gone into more detail about, you know, the first edition is still there for you.
Okay, I have to ask you about one movie that's not in there, and this is not some kind of aha, because I bet there are plenty of people who are waiting to do that.
Oh, and let me tell you, I was never promising that this was going to be complete. This is very subjective.
the movie I'm thinking of is Michael, John Travolta as the Archangel, and it takes place at Christmas time. The Christmas references and trappings are spare, at least. You are familiar with the movie?
I'm familiar with the movie, but I've never seen it. So that's a problem right there. I've never seen it, and it usually, like, I get pointed to things by people or lists that I see somewhere. And frankly, this is the first time hearing that this was a holiday movie. So, Ken, where were you when I was, you know, updating this book?
Well, I think calling it a holiday movie is a bit generous, because it's about an angel, or if you haven't seen it, maybe it's about an angel.
Sure.
And it takes place on the days leading up to Christmas, but it really has nothing to do with Christmas. It could happen at any time of year.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know, we get into this thing of like, is, you know, such and such really a Christmas movie? And I never argue about this with people, you know, like, except for I Will Die on the Hill of Die Hard as a Christmas movie, and I'm right. But, you know, I like, if somebody says, oh, well, I've always thought of, you know, I don't know, The Sound of Music as a Christmas movie, because we would watch it every year at the holidays, and, you know, my favorite things has become a Christmas song. I'm like, okay, sure. Like, knock yourself out. You know, I think that, you know, Eyes Wide Shut is a Christmas movie, and people want to fight me about that. And I'm like, watch it again. There's Christmas in practically every frame of that movie, except the orgy. You know, it's all over the place, and Kubrick does nothing by accident. So, yeah, it is very subjective. I think you can have really narrow definitions of like, oh, it has to have Santa or Jesus or, you know, whatever. But I think a lot of movies kind of fall into a broader category in which Christmas either provides a backdrop, is maybe an ironic counterpoint to, say, a horror movie or an action movie. You know, there are a lot of different ways to deal with it. And that's kind of why I wrote the first book in the first place, was because I think there were a lot of cool movies that people weren't necessarily thinking of as falling under the Christmas umbrella, but that I think can be enjoyed in that way.
I think I loved what you had to say about Die Hard in the book. My take on Die Hard is that it has to happen at Christmas, because they take over that tower because there's a Christmas party, and everybody else is gone because it's Christmas.
Yes,
it
exactly.
It couldn't happen any other time of year, so it has to happen then. I mean, the movie I was talking about, Michael, could happen any time.
Right.
But this has to happen at Christmas. So, like it or not, it has to be.
You know, like, there are a lot of movies where, you know, you get a Christmas scene, but only because, like, you're covering a year, you know, and that's a way to sort of let you know that time has passed. Or you'll get a movie like, say, you know, Hustlers from a couple years ago, the Jennifer Lopez movie, has a big scene where everyone's sitting around this ginormous Christmas tree exchanging gifts, and then that's it. And so you can classify that as Christmas or not. You know, like, I think John Waters' Female Trouble counts as a Christmas movie. It has one Christmas scene, but it is an unforgettable one where Divine throws the tree down at her parents because they didn't buy her cha-cha heels, you know. So it's very subjective. So yeah, if I included a movie you hate or I left out one that you love, it's like, it's because it's my book and I just sort of, you know, kind of had to sort of follow my own drum on that one.
Yeah, I think we all have movies or songs or TV specials that we gravitate towards at that time of year, whether or not they're traditional Christmas movies. I always think of The Sure Thing, which happens at Christmas, even though there's hardly any Christmas in it. John Cusack sings a little bit of the Christmas song,
yes,
drunk in a bar.
Right.
And it takes place during Christmas break. But other than that, I don't think there's anything Christmas related in it. But to me,
yeah, no, I count that one too. That was one that I had to cut back to a C also. But yeah, I like that movie a lot.
Your book has 9 or 10 chapters, I believe, and it's all very easy. Like films or films that are in certain categories are together. So the first section is movies for kids. And what I really like about this is that for a lot of these movies, I'm not sure if it's all, so I'll say for a lot, you add a little fun fact of things that people may not have known. For example, in the Christmas movies for kids, the recent version of The Grinch from 2018, the animated one, has earned more money in its original run than Home Alone. And it's the highest grossing Christmas movie of all time. I had no idea.
Yeah. I mean, probably not adjusted for inflation, but nonetheless, right. Yes. Yeah, that was news to me too, actually, when I was doing the research.
Yeah, that was just, and that was one where when it was coming out, I thought, oh, geez, they're redoing The Grinch again. And this is an animated version. Are you kidding? And I thought, this is just going to bomb. But I was obviously very wrong.
Yeah, and I was delightfully surprised by that one because I like many, felt burned by the 2000 version and thought, like, we already have a great Grinch cartoon. We don't need another one. And I really like what they did with it. I think it is a tricky thing to take a short, like, children's book and blow it up into, you know, 90 minutes of drama. But I thought this movie pulled it off. And I do the fun facts thing sort of throughout the book, actually, just because I think a lot of these movies have interesting little, you know, trivia tidbits about their making, you know.
And we go from movies for kids to movies for grown-ups is the next section. And the first film, which I never really thought about as a Christmas movie, but you're right, The Apartment, the classic Jack Lemmon movie from, I think, 1960.
60,
it
yeah.
takes place. It has to have Christmas in it.
Yeah, it's using the holidays as a counterpoint to sort of tragic events, but at the same time as a source of hope for characters who really need it.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about this book. Page after page after page, you're going to find movies that either you didn't think about this way, or maybe you missed the first time around, but it gives you lots of, if you love Christmas stuff, and really, if you're listening to a podcast like this, lots of pretty good that you do.
I should hope so.
Yeah. You're going to come across extra things to add to your repertoire of Christmas entertainment. Christmas comedies, 1941. I thought I was the only one that even thought of that in the genre of Christmas movies, but it's December and Hollywood is dressed up in the twinkling lights.
Yeah. It's an amazing recreation of what 1941 Hollywood Boulevard at Christmas time looked like. And it's all done like on the Universal backlot because they tried to do it on the real Hollywood Boulevard, but they would have needed to close businesses for like 2 weeks or something. And they wanted like the local businesses to chip in for the cost of it. And they were like, yeah, we'll pass. Thanks. So they had to rebuild the whole thing, you know, in the valley.
I finally made my wife watch that one and hopefully I'll bring her around to it. But near the end, when Ned Beatty's putting that wreath on his front door, I said, see? See? Christmas!
Yeah, that's actually a movie I had never seen before. And I always, it was sort of lived in infamy, you know, as this movie that kind of, you know, helped tank Spielberg's career after a couple of hits, you know. But I discovered that if you watch his director's cut, it's a lot better than what they released theatrically, because apparently what happened was he did his cut. They tested it. It didn't go well. And Universal thought, okay, this needs to be shorter. So they took out all the setups to the payoffs, you know, like anytime in a big, there's a big boisterous slapstick comedy, you have setups where you find out, okay, this person's going to be standing here, or this wall is going to be, you know, whatever. And then later in the movie, the wall falls or the thing happens that's funny. But if you take all the setups out and you just have the punchlines, it's not funny because you don't know why all this chaos is happening. So, and if you don't like either version, I get that too. This is a movie for people who like, you know, it's a mad world and like big kind of crazy, loud, you know, physical movies like that. But I think there's a lot of stuff that's really hilarious in it. And yeah, it is steeped in Christmas, because it is, in fact, December 1941, right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, it's like, I personally, I love 1941. It's just, and it's part of it is the nostalgia of having seen that with my dad in the theater.
Oh, wow.
But There's just something about it that I just really enjoy. You have a chapter on holiday tearjerkers, mm-hmm. including one that I had completely forgotten about, the homecoming that launched the Waltons.
Yes, which they actually remade a couple years ago, and I'm afraid to watch it. But like the CW did a new version of it. But yeah, the homecoming, it's most of the cast of the Waltons is in there, although the mother is played by Patricia Neal rather than Michael Learned. But it's it's kind of the setup for these characters and everything, and it's really beautifully done. And there are some real gut punch scenes, you know, and they really work the Christmas part of it, you know, it during the Depression and everything, really beautifully.
Yeah, this is, as opposed to some of the movies that we've been talking about, this really is, Christmas is really an important part. If you've never seen The Homecoming, Christmas Definitely. Is a very important part to that movie.
Yeah.
Crime and action section. We talked about Die Hard already, and I know people are writing their emails now, so save that. Holiday horror. I'm not a big horror movie fan, but one of the movies in there that I do love is Gremlins, which I'm sure,
yeah.
I guess a lot of people don't think about that as a horror movie. But if you've seen it.
Oh, it's a horror movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest horror fan in the world either. Like, this was the chapter I really had to sort of gird my loins for. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm gonna watch these now. Like, I even watched Terrifier 3 with my husband last year, which is and so over the top in its gore, and that's the point of it. But we basically watched it where he would say, all right, cover your eyes. And then he would, you know, I'd hear him respond to things, and then he'd go, okay, you can look again. Like, there was just, it was so much to deal with. But yeah, Gremlins is a lot of fun, and it is absolutely a monster movie, you know, and Joe Dante's stated intent was to sort of like have a monster movie unfold in the middle of It's a Wonderful Life. So you have this idyllic, snowy, small town with where these, you know, scaly creatures are suddenly running amok.
And one of the things that I didn't know, or at least didn't remember about Gremlins, was that Gremlins was part of the reason we got the PG-13 designation.
Yeah, it was funny. I was working in a movie theater that summer, so I witnessed all of this firsthand. Gremlins came out, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, and they both had like the Steven Spielberg seal of approval on them, and they were PG rated. And both times, you had kids coming out to the lobby screaming and crying, and the parents were furious. And because both those movies really push, you know, what you can get away with in that. And so, yeah, by August of that year, the PG-13 rating was in effect. It was like, okay, this wasn't an R movie, but you guys, we need to sort of tell parents something here. So it has that place among others in history.
And for any who say this isn't a Christmas movie, it's not the snow that makes it a Christmas movie. The gizmo was
is a gift.
It's a Christmas present.
Yeah. And Phoebe Cates has that whole insane monologue about Santa Claus.
Yeah. Yeah, I won't spoil that for anybody who hasn't seen
no,
it.
No, it's a treat.
Yeah. And then we get to A Christmas Carol, which has, I don't even know how many versions are out there.
Oh, there are entire books about Christmas Carol adaptations. I'm scratching the surface, even though I cover a couple of dozen in here. But there are so many, like, you know, silent films and episodes of TV shows and like films from other countries. I saw a Bangladeshi adaptation of A Christmas Carol this year that was set during the Muslim holiday of Eid, that was actually really good, called Ocho. But like, that is so frequently adapted. There's an insane amount of Christmas carols out there.
Do you have a personal favorite?
I really love Scrooge, the 1970 musical with Albert Finney. I don't know if you've talked about it on the show. The songs are by Leslie Bricus, who, you know, he and Anthony Newley collaborated on the Willy Wonka score and you know, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. I think that one's really gorgeous, and I love the look of it. It's got an amazing ensemble cast. Finney is one of the few actors to play young Scrooge and old Scrooge, which I think gives some heft to his sort of transformation from like hot young guy who looks like Albert Finney to, you know, miserly old crone. So yeah, that's probably my favorite. But, you know, I think if you love Alistair Sim, if you love the Muppets, you know, you're not wrong.
Yeah, I love that one too. That's another one I saw in the theater. I was a little kid. Oh, so that Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come and What Happens to Scrooge. That was way over the top for me when I was five.
Yeah, that's beyond what even Dickens wrote, that segment.
But there's so much that is wonderful about that. I really like Patrick Stewart's version.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Which I think includes, especially with The Ghost of Christmas Present, a look at, you know, the lighthouse and the prisoners and things like that kind of get glossed over in most of the versions.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that might be the most accurate one in terms of including, like, you know, the couple who is relieved to find out that Scrooge is gone, and so they don't have to worry about the debt. And yeah, the lighthouse, and you know, I had a checklist going for a while when I was going through all these. Like, does ignorance and want show up? You know, like I knew all the story beats, and you never know what you're going to get. I mean, the Robert Zemeckis one with Jim Carrey keeps in this weird line about bakeries being closed on Sunday, which, unless you have like the annotated version, good luck figuring out what that even means. You know.
It's one of my favorite Christmas stories, one of my favorite Christmas movies, the good adaptations of it. But I'm always a little leery when something new is coming. And when Spirited came out a couple years ago, I was like, they're treading on hallowed ground as far as I'm concerned. And Will Ferrell did that with that Sherlock Holmes movie, and I didn't even make it through the whole movie. Yikes, so I wasn't sure about this, but I was really pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
I thought they did a terrific job.
Spirited is a real charmer. And yeah, I also had a lot of trepidations about it. And I'm very hit and miss with Pasek and Paul, the songwriters. Like, I loved La La Land, but not a big fan of, like, you know, The Greatest Showman or Dear Evan Hansen. But yeah, I think the songs are great. I think there's a real, it's a smart take on A Christmas Carol as an existing property and sort of expanding, you know, beyond it. It's one that I try to get back to every year now. And in fact, as I'm setting up book events this year, I'm hoping I can talk somebody into screening it on the big screen, because I got to see it that way at a press screening, and I think most people have not. So,
yeah, I missed it. I think around here it was out for maybe just 1 week before it went to Apple Plus.
Yeah,
and I just couldn't get there. It was early November, and I just just couldn't make it. The next chapter is an area I don't always like to tread, the worst Christmas movies, because some of these, you know, taste is...
Absolutely.
But The Christmas That Almost Wasn't.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. And I know that there are people who love that movie, and I just can't.
Well, I think that so much of Christmas, the way that we celebrate it and we return to it every year, is about nostalgia. And I think there are times where, like, you saw a movie or a TV special or something when you were in that window between, like, 5 and 9 years old, and you just cling it to you forever, you know? Like, I really love the animated special, Twas the Night Before Christmas. And I can't defend it necessarily, but I saw it at the right age and have just sort of taken it with me through my life. And so, yeah, if you saw the Christmas that almost wasn't it, like a kiddie matinee when you were 7, and it's a cherished memory, then you're always going to see that movie through those eyes. And I don't begrudge you that. But having not seen it until I was an adult, I can tell you it's a terrible film.
And the songs just don't... There's nothing that for me at least, there's nothing that I carry with me from this movie except the taste that I ate something bad.
No, I agree.
It just doesn't. So easy to pivot from there to the Christmas classics.
Yes.
And It's a Wonderful Life. A lot of people don't realize that this movie that is much beloved now was a bomb when it came out.
Yeah. It was Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart's first movie after serving in World War II. Stewart was, flew bombing missions over enemy territory. And, you know, Capra had been making films for the War Department, or the Why We Fight series. And yeah, they had big plans for this, and it just did not do very well at all. And in fact, because it didn't do very well and kind of killed Capra's sort of nascent career as an independent producer, at one point the copyright fell into, expired. And then that's how it got scooped up by TV stations and shown wall to wall. When I was a kid in the 70s, it was always on. Like, you could you could change channels and catch it in various points of wherever, you were picking up on it. And that's when it became beloved. That's when people started watching it, realizing, oh, this movie's really great, actually. And I think, Ted Turner very cannily seized that strategy with A Christmas Story, which did okay in theaters and had like some following from, VHS or whatever. But it wasn't until he started putting it on, TBS or TNT or whatever for these 24-hour marathons that suddenly people are like, oh, right, A Christmas Story, But yeah, It's a Wonderful Life, when they talk about the definition of a cult film is very often a film that was not embraced by audiences originally, but that people found for themselves in later years, and It's a Wonderful Life absolutely falls into that category.
Yeah, I can remember one time in the late 70s, early 80s, the cable had gone out. Horrors. Mm. And if you don't know what that means, just email me and I'll explain it. But so I was flipping around the channels, and there was one snowy channel that didn't quite come in. And that's how I first watched It's a Wonderful Life, because was on whatever station that was.
Yeah.
And I love that it kind of became a punchline in the 80s because it was always on. But that's the same thing that propelled it into this holiday classic.
Yeah, exactly. And that was certainly nobody's intent, because, the TV station just wanted something they could show for free, But, they sort of accidentally turned this film into, a beloved classic. And so, the difference between that and then Ted Turner doing it with like, well, I have this movie and I want people to love this movie, so, we're going to go that way with it. Now, I mean, not that A Christmas Story isn't great, but I'm just saying, like, that's part of its trajectory as to how it kind of got to where it is today. But yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. I think it is as close as we've gotten to an American Christmas Carol, and I think that it accomplishes a lot of what the Dickens story does. I always half jokingly, but pretty seriously, sort of equate, like, Ebenezer Scrooge, George Bailey, and Kevin McAllister from Home Alone. They all, like, don't appreciate, their circumstances. They are shown an alternate version of what their lives could be or could have been. And that makes them come to understand like how good they actually have it. And so I think they're all these sort of all three of those characters travel a similar redemption arc. And there's something about that redemption arc that I think if you really want to get into what makes a Christmas movie, I think that's the secret sauce. If there's a character who, for one reason or other, it doesn't like Christmas or doesn't like members of his family or isn't a part of his community or isn't, being their best self, a really great Christmas movie at the other end of it, they will come to see what they can and should be for themselves and for other people.
You know, you could almost lump Bruce Willis's character from Die Hard in that too.
Absolutely, that's one of the things. Like, that's a movie about a couple getting back together at the holidays.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of trappings in there. Her the wife's name is Holly. That's some Hallmark syllogism, yeah, right there. I think it is. You can apply that to so many movies that we go back to at this time of year, because there is something about that people discovering their best selves and their kindest and most generous versions of themselves that really makes for a satisfying Christmas story.
Aside from everything that we've talked about so far, what was the most surprising thing that you can think of that you found out while you were putting all of this together?
Gosh. Well, I'll tell you, I had heard of Blast of Silence, but I didn't really understand how much of a Christmas movie it is. And it's not just that it was shot, in New York City with no permits at Christmas time, but it is very much about, Christmas as ironic counterpoint. You have this guy who is this sort of soul dead hitman coming to New York City to do this job at Christmas time, and he's completely ignoring the holiday, but he winds up crossing paths with a woman from his past and sort of rekindling this like last tiny bit of humanity that he had left. And so that was really fascinating. And then, of course, what's really, I think, always fun about low budget movies is they're almost like watching documentaries in a way, because they're so often shot without permits. They're not building sets. They're just like catching shots on the sidewalk. So if you want to see what New York City looked like at Christmas time, 1959, like, this movie will tell you, because there's no set dressing going on. They're just pointing a camera at what's already there. So stuff like that I found really fascinating. A thing that I've liked about this project overall, just from the beginning, is, and it really ties into Christmas music. I grew up in a household where we had like five Christmas albums, So we have Bing and Dean and, the Boston Pops and Andy Williams and a couple of others. And that was it. And that was my idea of Christmas music growing up. And then you get out in the world. And because, again, this is pre-internet. Nowadays, you don't have to go out in the world. But, you get out in the world and realize, oh, Ella Fitzgerald or, Ray Conniff or whoever else, there's all these different choices. And so I think, having grown up in a house where It's a Wonderful Life was always on because it was always on, it was exciting to sort of, again, diversify your holiday palette. And if that means you get so many choices that you have to just spread them out to the rest of the year, well, so be it.
Yeah, I feel the same about music. Certainly, I also run the Sounds of Christmas online station.
Yeah.
And I started that because I just feel like there's so much great Christmas music out there, and radio stations, even though they go all Christmas for six or 7 weeks, it's the same 100 songs over and over.
And that's, retailers, the same thing.
Yeah. And that's why I think you mentioned Christmas music to some people and they want to put a gun in their mouth, because it's it's Mariah and Bing over and over and over. Yeah. And there's so much more even with those.
Can
two
I interest
artists.
You in Pearl Bailey's 5-pound box of money? You want to like steer them to this other stuff that's so great that they've never heard.
Yeah. Even with just Mariah and Bing, they did so much more than the two songs you hear on the radio.
Yeah.
So there is so much more that's out there. And your book certainly shows that with movies. There's many that I haven't heard of. There's many that I have heard of and forgot that Christmas was even a part of that. And there's others that I just, you forget about.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to diving in and watching some of these, even though it's September. But this is, so this book is just out. What's next for you?
Oh man. You know, telling people that this book exists, that's, sure. You know, now through the holidays will be me going on every podcast that will have me and saying, "Hey guys, I wrote a book, please buy it." So yeah, that for is my impending future. And then beyond that, I don't know. My two main areas of sort of, you know, academic interests have been, you know, Christmas movies and LGBTQ plus cinema. And I wrote a very lengthy book about the latter last year. It came out last year called Hollywood Pride. But again, both of those books are kind of seasonal. So, you know, every June I got Hollywood Pride to push. And then every December I'll have, you know, Movie Little Christmas. So it took a good 10 years or so for me to get the original edition of this into royalties. So, you know, I'll be hawking this one for a while. And of course, always also, if you're a Hallmark fan, I co-wrote a book with the guys at the Deck the Hallmark podcast called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, which is a really fun guide to more than 100 Hallmark movies, plus tips on, you know, throwing a Hallmark party, and there's a bingo card and all kinds of other fun stuff.
And with Hallmark, holy cow, in another year or two, you'll be ready to update that one, because
just about, yeah. Yeah. They, you know, every year is another 40 or 50 titles. So it's bananas.
It is crazy. What's the best way for people to catch up with you?
Well, I am alonzo.duraldi on Instagram. I'm at @aduraldi on Blue Sky. And I think that's also my, I'll tell you, I'm the easiest person on earth to Google, because there's, apart from a distant relative who was just born this year, I'm the only Alonzo Duraldi on earth. So put my name into a search engine and you'll find me.
Okay. I'll put links to your socials down in the show notes, along with a link to, do you have a preference for where people can find this book, or should they just go find it?
I have a card page. I'll send you the link that has links to several retailers. And so, take your pick. You know, if you want to get it online, also feel free to bug your favorite local brick and mortar bookseller. And you know, hey, while you're at it, ask your library to snag a copy too. You know,
yeah, people always forget that. Go to your library, because that counts and that helps authors
when
they get. They get those books in. So if it's not on the shelf there,
and this is one of these things that I like to nag people about. Everybody should have a library card. Go to your local library card. Go to your local library, get a card. Even if you rarely or never use it, you are in the system, and at least they can point to the numbers of people that have come in to get library cards, which helps them when they're trying to get funding and stuff. And also, it's quite likely that having a library card, in addition to a lot of tons of other things, gets you access to some really great streaming services like Canopy and Hoopla that carry a lot of Christmas movies. And in fact, I think Hoopla even gives you can get like a week-long subscription to Hallmark Plus. So, you know, if you don't have cable and, you know, December rolls around, you just want to get your Hallmark fix, your library card could be the way that happens.
And we're not even sponsored by the library, by the
way. No. Libraries are great.
Yes.
And they're free.
Yes. Yeah. And there's so much more than just, not that getting books isn't enough, but there's so much more.
Yeah.
Go check out
DVDs and, I mean, you know, parking passes for your local state park. You'd be amazed. Ask your librarian. They'll tell you.
Yes. And they'll happily tell you.
Yes.
This has been so much fun. Thanks so much for making time to do this.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, sir. Thank you for the good work you do throughout the years, and you know, for your online radio station, which is, you know, I think we all need to pop in every so often and get that fix. And so it's good that it's there.
And thank you so much for listening, helping us share some Christmas spirit, and for continuing to support the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast. I already told you how to listen to the station, and you're listening to the podcast now, so my work here is just about done. All of our episodes are available on the Sounds of Christmas website. Just click the podcast tab. And we also have a Linktree page that lists most, if not all, of the sites that stream the Sounds of Christmas podcast. And I'll put a link to that down in the show notes, so you can click on that, find your favorite, and click on over. Then subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode. If you have comments or suggestions on this episode, previous episodes, or the Sounds of Christmas station, feel free to reach out to me on social media or through the website. And if you're listening to this episode on your phone, you can also click the Send Us a Text Message link and connect that way. Thanks again, and may you always believe in Santa Claus.